Doom Fidget, a BFRB podcast.
Hey everyone, my guest this episode is Stacy Nickell. She is a registered clinical social worker working out of Austin, Texas, and has recently published a book called Treatment for Body-Focused Repetitive Behaviors, an Integrative Psychodynamic Approach. I had the pleasure of reading it, and in this episode, we talk about what sets psychodynamic approach apart, BFRBs in animals, and the role of attachment. But before we get to that, Stacy is also a boxer and boxing coach, and so I asked her about how her boxing world overlaps with her therapy one. Hope you enjoy.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think for me, I mean, so much of my journey as a recovering skin picker, as somebody who's trying to learn about myself, heal myself, teach my therapist how to help me with that, and then really learn how to get to the root of some of the body focused behaviors of my clients, I really needed to find a way to discharge some of the energy that built up for me around skin picking. And for me, that was very much aggressive energy that had built up. And that was very clear. My first experience with, I had always picked my skin since I was an adolescent, but my first experience was with like really intense skin picking was when I was furious at someone. And I really know how to express it. And so I went into the bathroom and I picked my face and I was relieved. And so for me, that connection was very clear. I knew I was furious. So for me, it was like, well, that seems to be a lot of this energy. And that was the best way to use it in the moment. Like there was, I wanted to like shake this person. And so rather than that, you know, I found another way to discharge, but I think that's where boxing really came in because I needed to find a way for it to come out, and it needed to be also in a way that wouldn't hurt others and wouldn't hurt myself beyond the boundary of the ring.
Right.
And so that was, I had witnessed a boxing match when I was in fifth grade. And so, and it was in the Olympics. And so just that blood and sweat, it just like, even back then, like I always had like this, because they were getting their aggression out in ways that were like brutal, but within bounds.
Right.
So there was always,
yeah. Wow. I love how you described that. I know very little about boxing, but, my assumption is that, like, you know, different boxers have different styles. I couldn't begin to describe one of them. But do you think you have like a boxing style? I don't know if that question makes sense.
It does. It does. Well, I will say this. I'm actually a better boxing coach than I was ever actually as a boxer. Because so now I'm a boxing coach and I love that. But as a boxer, I kind of came in, like I said, with so much aggression and sort of with this attitude of like, I don't care. Like if you hit me while I'm hitting you, like I just care about hitting you. And so I was so aggressive that defense was really like, I had to back up and bring in defense. And so, of course, with all of my boxers that I work with as an amateur coach, you don't want to get hit in the head very much. So you don't have all that long to learn that you have to be defensive. So for me, really, it was less about kind of perfecting my own boxing as it was learning just that way of channeling aggression outward. And now I do that on a boxing bag, that's good enough. Me, but back then there was something about I needed to make contact. There was also something about just getting in touch with my own strength and power. I had always been a submissive person and an insecure person. I needed it to come into myself as well as to find a way to get that energy out of my hand. So for me, it sort of was life-saving in a weird way. Although I wouldn't recommend it. Like, I don't recommend it, you know, unless you have to go all the way there, you know, just spar a little bit. But,
Yeah. Okay. So, too much energy out of the gate. No regards for defense. I love it. And so, okay, Stacey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I was really excited for you to come on, especially for you to talk about your new book that, you know, like you mentioned, you spent 10 years writing. Something that I heard in your boxing story was like, yeah, it was like a cool, like, channel, a place to channel your energy and like having it come out in a certain way. I don't know. Was like the process of writing a book similar? Like, you know, you having to channel some inner force inside of you and yeah, like
that's
coming out in a certain way.
That's a great question. Absolutely. Yeah. It really did feel like that. It felt like in so many ways, connected to my journey around skin picking as well, because I had a whole story inside of me and a whole healing story inside of me that came into being, sort of started before the book. But then as I wrote the book and understanding myself better, like that was part of my own healing process, which I really wouldn't have expected. And so, but it really made it clear to me sort of when I talk about how important it is to tell your story and to claim your story, understand your story. So change it from whatever you might have thought, like when you were a child and you thought, oh, like I'm unlovable, for example. And then you have to figure out how to change that story to, wait, I'm angry because maybe I wasn't loved right, but I'm lovable. And that's part of that change. And so I feel like writing the whole book was like almost a love letter to my younger self, which was like, wait, this is not, you're not picking your skin because you're bad or you're gross or something's wrong with you or you're hopeless. It's because you're trying to make sense of the world and you can't, and you're finding a way to cope with things that otherwise you wouldn't be able to cope with. So, you know, so figure out why you're doing it, figure out what you need. And then that's how you heal it. And for me, that was also tied in with sort of this frustration with the field as it was, because when I came into the scene and came into the first time that I presented at the Trichotillomania Learning Center retreat, which I believe was 2009.
Oh, wow.
And I went to like Charlie Mansueto's 3-day cognitive behavioral training. And then I also held a training, which was about the chakras. So I was on a much different, I was on a very integrative path even back then. And what I found was that I needed so much more that a workshop, a worksheet really, like there was something frustrating to me inherently about a worksheet. Like, why are you picking? What are the triggers? Well, I'm lonely. So then how can I write in a box? How can I solve that on my own, on a worksheet? It was so frustrating. I thought, well, you know, if I could solve that on a worksheet, you know. And so for me, I always needed like the deeper approach and always looked for that in the literature and couldn't find it. And finally, I just had to write it myself. So that was also like that frustration in me created that energy to write the book. So I would say the book was definitely a process of its own that really was part of healing for me.
Right. Totally. In the same way that boxing saved your life, this book also saved your life.
Very similar. Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. I see some parallels and I feel very grateful to have found both outlets.
Yeah, totally. Like as you described that, like, were you like surprised that you found yourself writing a book? Or did you, like, from a small child, you're like, I know I'm going to write a book someday. I just don't know what about what.
That's such a good question. Well, okay. So writing was the only thing, like, yes, I was good, always good at writing. Like I won a little prize of like a $25 prize in third grade. Into the chat, right? And then I did when I was in fifth grade, we got to write a book of stories and we bound it. And labeled, you know, with like one of those like labelers, old school. And mine was about unicorns. And so Yes. And so I would say, like, having that experience in fifth grade where that was the assignment. Mm. I mean, that was a great assignment, right? Mm. Like bind your book and take it seriously. And so I would say that. And then I was always writing short stories in college. I loved that. But it didn't really occur to me to write a book about my work until sometime after that conference in 2009. Mm. And then I know I wouldn't have written a book, except that at that time I got advice from a friend to get a writing coach. And so I got a writing coach. Oh. And she was with me for the whole 10 years. And that's how I wrote a book, was like having assignments to turn in every week to her, and then getting her critiques that were sometimes so harsh, and made it from like this. I mean, I really feel like I learned how to write professionally, academically, by writing, because I didn't get my PhD. I didn't have that experience of writing from a scientific perspective and grounded in all the literature and all of that. so, yeah, I had to discover that.
Yeah. Wow. I love that. If it's too embarrassing to share, definitely you don't need to. But do you remember like one of these harsh critiques that you had to like learn from? Like,
okay. Well, this is the harshest critique. This wasn't from her.
Okay.
This was from one of my mentors, Dr. Molenlash, and he was one of my, for my book to get published, I had to find my own three reviewers, which was a very hard part of the process, because like I had to come out of my comfort zone to like ask people to do this for me and build those relationships. And so Dr. Lesh, he had read an early version of my manuscript, and he had recommended it for publication, but then he called me, or he asked me to call him. He lives in Newfoundland. So we got on a Zoom call, and he said, "Stacy, like, I think I had about 6 weeks left to finish the book and submit it, the final version." And he said, "Stacy, like, I just need to tell you, I've been thinking about it, and I really need you to update all of your references," because it had already been a year since I had written what I'd written. And he's like, "You need to update them all. I want them all between, you know, 2015 and 2022. And I need you to redo this chapter. And and I need you to really expand on your processing of transference and countertransference. And I'm really thinking we need to do this for you to get taken seriously." And I was like, "Oh my God. Oh my God, I have 6 weeks." And so I did, somehow I always stepped up to the challenge, but I worked about 10 hours a day on each of my days off, and I took some days off work, and I went to a few different bed and breakfasts and just sat myself down, and I was like, "I cannot disappoint Dr. Lesh." And so that was the harshest, I would say.
Okay. But, yeah.
I rewrote the book in that 6 weeks, and it is so much better. I'm so glad he challenged me. Yes, as he did.
Okay, that sounds quite intense. Oh my goodness. I think something that I heard once, it's like, I think such a big part of the creative process is like asking for feedback. And I think that is something I myself am like learning how to do, because like there's also a skill into like getting like seeking feedback and receiving feedback, also sometimes I think something I struggle with is like feeling the need to like incorporate every suggestion that I receive, and like, yeah, like learning how to like filter some of that out, or like ultimately it still comes back down to me of like, I need to make the decision whether or not the feedback like makes sense for what I need to do.
No, that's so true. And actually after that conversation, it's funny, I was quite deflated.
Mm.
And I really went into a hole of like, I may not actually finish this thing. I may have come this far and I may not actually do it. And I did touch base with some of my, so I had been in a writing group for several years that was women group therapists writing about our aggression, which was a big part of how this book also kind of, they kept me accountable, and they have, many of them have written chapters now too. And it's been a creative bunch, but I ended up touching base with them because they had just finished their process, their book coming out actually the year before. And they really held me. I just cried. And I was like, this is the feedback I got. I have 6 weeks. Like, I don't know if I can do it. And just hearing from them, you know, what those last several weeks were like before they got to publication, and just that they all did it. And also just that, like, yeah, kind of like you said, like, yes, his voice is very important. He has very important feedback for me, but it's still my project. And there was some way I was just like, oh, I'm really not good enough. Oh, I really am not at the level. Like, I don't have my PhD. I'm not, you know, I can't do it.
Right.
And then asking for help is an interesting point, because then I did also, I have a friend, Dr. Mohammad Jafarani, who always supported me. And what I realized was I didn't have access to the most recent literature. I had to pay for each and every article. I wanted to get that, and that was actually made it inaccessible to me. And so Dr. Jafarani, he is such a busy man. He is so busy. He's always traveling to conferences all around the world. And for that 6 weeks, I'd be like, can I have this article? And he'd send it to me. Can I have this article? And he'd send it to me. And so actually, that was the other piece. Like, I really had to reach out emotionally to my community, but also reach into that privilege. Someone who had something that would have otherwise disqualified me.
Right.
So that was a big deal too. And it's kind of fun to remember this as you're asking about it, because it really did come down to leaning on other people.
Yeah.
And then something willing.
Yeah, totally. Oh my goodness. That's so fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah,
that like accessibility piece about like, you know, like how are these resources available to people who want to create, and some of the barriers, you know, very real, like the emotional barriers, like the insecurity, but also, yeah, just kind of like institutional barriers. It's so complicated.
Right. Right. And the way that you sort of have to be, you have to have published to be taken seriously, but then how do you publish if you're not if you don't, you know, how do you get started? Someone has to take a chance on you, or you know, or they can block you out if they want to.
So I think you know, one of the points that I wanted to chat with you about today was sort of this like tension that exists between, you know, maybe more a cognitive behavioral approach versus the psychodynamic. You know, I think I feel like CBT has almost become synonymous with like therapy these days. Like, it's just so like omnipresent. Like you said, like sometimes it's just a worksheet, and I don't know, it just lands on your desk and you're like, this is supposed to solve me. I don't know. Would you be able to like speculate? Like, why do you think CBT has become such like a force, and why do you think maybe like something like psychodynamic has, like, I don't know, just like not as popular, it's not as widespread? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Sure. Well, I will say before I get to that point, I will say that I do appreciate that the CBT realm around body focused repetitive behaviors, you know, they have done a lot of research that's shown maybe some positive initial results, and then a real relapse rate. And so the community has begun to respond by looking at some of the real weaknesses and correcting for them. So like the acceptance and commitment model and the dialectical behavioral therapy model both come in and add like a key component of self-compassion, which if you're just going for the goal of stopping a behavior, self-compassion really wasn't the focus for a long time. And that increased shame, which then kind of led to more of that cycle of success and relapse and shame. And So I will say that I appreciate that, that more and more people are actually paying attention to some of the complexities and some of the deeper needs that might come into play. And what I'll say is that I think the model originally, one of the benefits is it's a short-term model. And because it's focused on behaviors, it's sort of measurable. And it's preferable if you can fix something in a way that you can do in 8 weeks, or, you know, we want to relieve people of their suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some people, when they think of psychodynamic, they think of both psychoanalytic, which was the grounding for psychodynamic work, but it's come a long way from the Freudian ideas into what I would say the key to the psychodynamic piece, which I think is still left out of the cognitive behavioral piece, even with other things added in, is the primacy of the therapeutic relationship. So really grounding it in attachment theory has both the potential to create deeper change, but also is going to be longer term. And you're going to come up against people's resistances and defenses, and you're going to have to move slowly at times, and you're going to come into some of the complicated factors that people don't really like to look at. Like that, there is a lot of connection between attachment struggles and body-focused repetitive behavior. So divorce is a huge precipitating factor found all throughout the literature. And so if you say we don't have to think about the roots, well, we don't have to go into all the grief and anger and confusion and attachment disruptions that may have been part of that divorce. But if we leave that behind, then we're sort of leaving behind sort of this untended field, solving a problem over here, but then here's this field. And if I'm not picking anymore, I might just start overeating, or I might start drinking more, or because this place where I have pain hasn't been touched. And that's the piece that I think people in America, and particularly, and I don't know about Canada, but in our modern world, we're very resistant to sitting with our feelings and really sitting with them in a way that's not like, oh, I feel sad, okay, let me do something different. But, oh, I feel sad and I don't know why I feel sad. And maybe I have to sit with this with someone and really process this feeling. And maybe it's going to really hurt. And maybe it'll change the way I think about my childhood. Maybe I'll realize that I had an early surgery that affected me somehow to this day. And nobody knew it would have that effect. But as we're learning now, anything that happens to a child's nervous system leaves a mark in the body.
Totally.
So all those things are not easy. They're not easy to measure when you make progress, and they're not going to take 8 weeks.
Yeah, totally. Oh, thank you so much, Stacey. So much of what you just said. Yeah, just so resonates with me. Really? And I think what I've been like learning on my journey is, you know, it's not a quick fix, and it's not something to just like gloss over. And, you know, just the other day I was in like this group call with, some like other like counselors, therapists, and, there was a newer counselor, and they were sort of sharing how like, they're just like recently graduated from this university, and like the whole like university model just like is like CBT based, right? Like the whole program is CBT based. And I'm like, I guess like, you know, I think like CBT is something because it doesn't, you know, like get into the roots of it. It like, you can teach it, right? Like you can just like, you sit in a classroom and be like, well, if you follow these like, you know, four steps, if you focus on the behaviors, here you go, you know? And yeah, like, I think, you know, maybe schools can just start be churning out, you know, just like CBT practitioners. Right. But I think it really requires, I mean, you were sharing so far about your journey with like boxing and writing and like your own like skin picking. And it's just like, yeah, like, only way almost to kind of like guide someone else through their trauma. Not the only way, but I feel like in order to like speak about these things in a quote unquote like authentic way is kind of like having done your own work.
That's such a great point, Jason.
And like you said, like I think, well, all these institutions that are created in North America, you know, Canada included, like, you know, even a university is also just a business, right? Like they're just cranking out degrees. Like we can't, you know, you can't go through your trauma in your freshman class. Like, So I don't know. Just kind of, again, yeah, nothing against.
Vulnerable. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
And that's not the academia kind of mode. It's not about being vulnerable and not knowing everything. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. And like you also shared earlier about like this tension you had with the kind of like the expert, right? And you kind of, you had this resistance to like lecturing and, you know, you kind of want your process and like in your therapy work, like to be collaborative. And so, yeah, it's just so interesting, this like tension of, you know, authority and like, this is the right way to do it. And like, here's how you CBT or whatever. Yeah. So I don't know.
Right. And it also, there's no question. Yeah, it also sort of neutralizes everything, you know, like neutralizes differences too. And I mean, I think that's another place where we don't want to consider how complex anything is. And this body focused repetitive behaviors being part of that too. Most people don't even talk about all the complexities of how race and ethnicity and religion and ability and everything else can all be reflected in skin and hair and customs. And I mean, all the way to, you know, reflecting your status through your hairstyles and your makeup and how complex all of that is, whatever it is that we may be playing out on our hair and skin may not be just our own personal story. And how do you capture all that complexity in like those four steps that you mentioned?
Totally. Yeah. And that's another piece that we've kind of a theme in our conversation so far is like, yeah, like anger you know, you're sharing with me like kind of, yeah, the aggression that you were carrying inside of you. And I think sometimes it's hard to be like angry at quote unquote, the system, right? Like just these like systems of oppression and how we've been maybe socialized to, yeah, like suppress our feelings, suppress our anger. And like, you know, it's not very ladylike or, you know, it's not feminine to have aggression, right? And, you know, people like don't want to talk about it, right? I think it's hard. Yeah.
Right. Definitely. And I know like, you know, on that realm, you know, skin is our boundary. And lately I've been thinking a lot about kind of some of those metaphorical pieces and how sometimes when our boundaries are invaded over and over, then sometimes this kind of motion is almost like, even though we're sort of also taking off parts of our skin, there's a way it feels like protective, like keeping others out. And just thinking about how that plays into, you know, all the way to a way to cope with being sexually assaulted, to more subtle boundary violations. I like to think about animals and the connection between animal behaviors and our human behaviors. And I was just so struck once. I was on the beach by myself, but I was near a pocket of gulls. And I noticed that I kind of wanted to get closer to them, to observe them. And so most of them started walking away as I started getting closer. So there was one who was still there, and I took like another step, and the one who was still there started over grooming, like really seriously, like side to side. And I was like, oh my gosh, this bird is communicating that I am in its space. And it's the brave one who's standing right there to hold the space. But it just told me, like, you're stressing me out. Get away. And so I was like, okay. So I backed off and moved my, you know, moved my stuff. And I just thought about that, like, how much it's so easy in a social situation if somebody's kind of too close to us just to be like, okay, you know, like there's something here. It's a barrier. And so all of these thoughts are not as well thought out, like I said, but there's something about how our skin is a boundary. And I know as a woman in particular, that has informed something about how I've utilized my skin to help me cope.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like that story with the birds. I don't know, maybe this, like, you know, we think about the different like fight flight responses. And, you know, maybe the other birds, their response is like, okay, I'm going to walk away, you know, like this boundary is too close. Okay, let's keep moving. But I think there are some of us out there who, you know, we take that freeze response. We're just like rooted in place. We don't know how to, like, big human walking at me, I don't know how to respond. You know, and then the tension, you know, yeah, goes to over grooming.
Exactly, Jason. But also, as you say that, it's making me think too, like it's the freeze response, but then also the fawn response, the people pleasing, the let me make this okay, let me make you feel okay, let me drop contact with what I'm feeling and what my body might be communicating as it leads my hand up, and let me just like deal with the situation. And I think that is so much the characteristic, the overarching characteristic of people who end up in this, with this particular dilemma of body focused behaviors, is that people pleasing. And so not listening to our bodies, which are communicating something we may well need, but not know how to ask for.
Yeah. I was listening to another podcast the other day. I think it was like Brené Brown interviewing Emily and Amelia Nagoski. Have you heard of these people before?
Not the Nagoski.
Okay, fair enough. So they wrote this book on like burnout, and it talked about how like emotions get like sort of trapped in our body, and that like creates burnout because like the emotions never like leave. We're just continuing to carry sort of our traumas, our emotions with us. And they talked about, well, okay, I'm kind of missing the point, but in the podcast episode, they talked about how there's almost this like social, like society has like value, has ranked the different responses. Like, I think being in this like patriarchal society, fight is like, I viewed as the best one, you know, like fight is kind of like the brave, the hero. That's what they're going to do. If they get pushed down, they're going to like, you know, fight back. And then flight comes down after that of like, okay, well, you know, if you can't fight, sure, makes sense. You run away. But then, yeah, the freeze and the fawn are maybe more seen as like submissive, weak, feminine. Like there's this morality attached, or not this morality, I don't know if that's the right word, but there's this sort of like ranking that's like lower on the hierarchy. So if that is the trauma response that you reach to, you are just less of a person. But what they talked about in the podcast was like, no, like it's your body just like doing what it needs to do to survive. And sometimes your body's making the decision of actually freezing makes more sense than fighting right now. And yet society's like, well, that's wrong.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. Like, yeah. And it brings you back to the self-compassion piece. If you can just see it as, the way I survived, well, you've got to have some respect for that instead of like, oh my God, I hate it that I'm such a people pleaser.
Yeah. you had a bit of this in the book, but I would love, you know, to spend a little time exploring with you. Like, how do you begin reframing that self-compassion piece? You know, if someone comes into your office and is like, "Ah, Stacey, like, pick my skin, like, you know, I'm a people pleaser, and that for that reason, that makes me a bad person."
Yeah, totally. Well, I think number one, it's the first task of therapy, because you really can't get anywhere if you don't address the shame, and then the self-compassion is the antidote to the shame. So you're asking like, basically, yeah, like the most important question. And I would say the first thing is the conversation we just had. I think a lot of people don't really even think about that this is a coping mechanism. They just think about it as a weird thing. Like, they really don't even realize that it's how they've coped. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, introducing them to more of that psychoeducation piece in a lot of ways, like, number one, just knowing that people who tend to pick and pull have more sensitive central nervous systems, usually sensitive skin. And so it may just be harder to calm themselves down. That can bring compassion, just like, oh, okay. Like, yeah, maybe I'm going to have to work a little harder to soothe myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually bringing in the animal piece, I find is so helpful, because we can't always have compassion for ourselves, but I find that people who pick and pull, one of their sensitivities is they tend to be the most sort of sensitive to animals and connected to animals. And so number one, that's a positive, like, okay, so there's something good about this. But number two, if you think about animals who do behaviors like over-grooming in whatever way, it's important to note that they don't do it when they're out in the wild. They do it when they are in our stressful human environments. And so what is it that makes them do it? Well, they've found, the veterinarians have kind of discovered, that it's boredom, isolation, being trapped in too small of a space, and frustration. And so once I can sort of look at it that way with people, they can sort of say, well, wait, I do it because of one of those two. And so, wait, so my body's responding to my environment. It's not that I'm weird or I'm bad or I have this thing. And thinking of it as, we all have a certain capacity for stress. And when it goes over that point, we're going to do some behavior. So rather than even thinking about it, like, let me stop doing this behavior, let me look at my stressors and see how I can reduce them. And they usually are in one of those four categories. And so, like, just starting to think about it as, my goal is not to stop picking or pulling. My goal is to take better care of myself in ways that I haven't learned yet, so that I can soothe some of these sore spots that the picking and pulling has been soothing. And so that's where the framework shifts. And usually it's that animal piece where, even the hardest, you know, I'll have somebody who's like, never, it's the worst thing. And then I'll be like, I have somebody who had no compassion for themselves. But I do video with them, and their dog started over grooming, and they just started talking to their dog. Oh, I won't say the dog's name. Stop that, honey. Like, come here, snuggle with me. And I was like, look at you.
Yeah.
Look at you. You just showed such sweetness. Can you show that to yourself when you do it? And that, I mean, that did it. You know, it's compassion. Yeah. You can build it when you have compassion for someone in your similar situation, a little removed.
I love that. That's such a, like,
it's so sweet.
I love that way into sort of like exploring the compassion piece. I don't know if you run into this sometimes where it's like, I feel like some people, they don't like feel like they deserve the compassion, right? Or they feel like, I was chatting with someone the other day, and they were saying, like, I need to like be self-critical on myself, right? Like I need to like monitor my behavior. I need to like, you know, really push and like, I'm on a diet and you know, like I need to exercise this much, because if I don't do it, like what's going to happen, right?
Right. Well, and Dr. Kristen Neff, she's out of UT, right here near me, in Austin. And she did studies literally debunking that. So I'll bring that right in. Okay. You know, lots of people feel like they'll be more motivated if they're mean to themselves. But studies show that actually, especially on losing weight, the more you try to lose weight, the worse it is. If you come towards something with hate, it won't move, or it'll get bigger, or it'll fight back. Like we have to respect our own resistance to change. And if we just fight it with hate, we're not going to get somewhere. And so that doesn't always change it, but at least it takes away that complete adherence to the idea that you have, that it's a good thing.
Right.
Yeah. I think a lot of people feel that way, but it's like, well, is it working for you? Has it motivated you?
Yeah. I feel like people are at a loss though. I mean, I get it. Me too. Like, I think I put so much pressure on myself and like, you know, I'm like, oh, Jason, you just need to like work harder. Like that's the reason why, you know, you're still picking your skin or whatever, you know, right. I kind of internalize this message of like, well, if you were a stronger person, if you had more willpower, like you wouldn't need to, whatever it is. But like, I only know how to meet myself with hate. That compassion piece is so foreign. It seems wrong, you know, like it's not intuitive.
Right. And that's the part where I would say, this is where the relationship comes in. So important, because the way I think about attachment, I think, and people are like, I don't want to go back to when I was younger. Like, that's ridiculous. Or like, here we are in the present. And I'm like, no, actually the way we form as humans is we have a attachment figure, however many important people, and we sort of put them in ourselves, and that's our template. And that's a really sort of simplified way to think about it. But if I have a voice that says like, I'm not good enough, or I'm not lovable, or this makes me disgusting, it's helpful to think, where did I come upon that voice? Usually people don't just make up those voices on their own for no reason. And so we have to look at, how did that voice help you through? And that's another coping mechanism. Being self-attack is a coping mechanism. So I know where I learned my self-attack. I got really negative messages from my dad about me, and especially about my voice when I wanted to speak up for myself. And so that was a part of me I hated, but it was the most important part. So I couldn't have gotten rid of that voice all on my own. That's not the way we work as humans. And that's where sort of the idea of like affirmations, it can be annoying to me, because it's like, well, yeah, once you get to a certain point, you can use affirmations to help support your cognitions. But it's about, does someone see you in a way that you can then change the way you see yourself? So that's what I have to offer my clients more than anything, is I see you. I can give you a different voice. I can tell you something. And because we have this deep relationship where I am sort of working on having you attached to me, I can get through in ways that, you know, and it usually involves also letting go. And I'm thinking, when you get through to someone in that way, there's usually tears. It's usually a grief, because if you're just holding on to these negative ideas about yourself, you don't have to grieve that maybe someone gave you these messages and, you know, maybe they were doing their best and still, you know, didn't know how to, maybe your mother was always looking at herself in the mirror and talking about how ugly she was. And that's how you got that. And that's okay. But what if now you and I are together and we can create a different story?
Yeah.
So that's where the hard work comes. But I mean, my favorite thing is when someone says like, they were home and they were thinking something bad. And then they thought, what would Stacy say? And then they had a new thought. And that's really how we work. We really work in relationship, and things that are damaged in relationship are also healed in relationship. And that's the depth of the work. So that's what I would say about that. It's about excavating and recreating the story because, again, I like to say people come upon those things honestly. You come upon your lack of confidence honestly. And so let's respect it. It's there for a reason, but how can we change the story and create a new one? It's hard.
Whoa, it's hard. And that speaks to the kind of like the intergenerational piece, right? Of I'm not just healing me. I'm healing like my parents. They don't know it yet, but like I like the whatever deficits that my parents started with, or like my parents' parents, or like how many generations back has this violence been perpetuated, right? And kind of beginning this, you know, like attachment work, psychodynamic work, whatever work it is that you're doing, it's beginning and being like, like I have to like stop this snowball that has been just like gaining momentum for so many years.
Right. And it's painful. I think that's the other piece. I think therapy can be painful. It's painful to let someone else into those wounds.
Totally. Yeah. A visual I've been kind of using recently is like, it's like staring into the sun, right? Like, it's just like, there's like too much truth there. And you can't look at it directly, you know, like it's hard to just like if you just try to stare directly at it, you're also going to burn yourself out. Right. Like,
right. And that's also true. Like if you try to go directly at someone's sense of themselves. So if someone says to you, if you're like, I really don't like myself. I'm really no good. And someone says, yes, you are, Jason. You're the best, you know, and go straight at it in that way. You know, it's not going to work. Totally. And you said something about, going around. And that's the way you always have to go around people's resistances. And one of their resistances is resistance to being loved. You have to sneak your way in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Another thing that I hear sometimes is like when people are in that like denial piece, this was another question that I had sort of like, you know, I think sometimes, you know, people throw out the word trauma and I think there's this like, I don't know, like trauma's like almost like too much of like a heavy word, you know? And I think people often say like, I don't have trauma, or like, you know, my childhood wasn't traumatic. And like, it's like too big of a word to like use almost. And I think that almost goes hand in hand with, that like denial piece. And like that, I don't know if it's that attachment piece as well, but like, like I think that's part of the disconnect, right? Like they don't see skin picking, hair pulling, nail biting as a coping mechanism, because they're like, well, what do I need to cope with?
So I guess I will say first that from my perspective, so I think being trauma informed as a therapist is critical. And all that means is you never underestimate the potential role of trauma in any behavioral condition. So I have plenty of clients who wouldn't say they've experienced trauma. And plenty who have. So it's really more like it's a problem if you decide to ignore the potential of trauma in the picture. So I will also say a couple other things about that. One is that people who tend to develop these disorders, like I mentioned, usually have a more sensitive nervous system and are more sort of emotionally sensitive for whatever reason, maybe genetic, maybe something else. But just that, like, people all experience things differently. So if you are a more sensitive person, you may experience something as more traumatic than somebody who was less sensitive. Right. And so there are all these components of what makes something traumatic, and it's very personal. Did it all trauma means is it went beyond your normal coping mechanisms and you couldn't cope with the coping mechanisms you had. So you had to develop maladaptive ones to cope with that situation. It was beyond you. And so something split off, whether it was emotion or cognition or memory or sense, like you have to leave your body in some way or you can't cope. So that's really important to know. Each person has a different experience of the same situation, and we can't just generalize. And then also, I mean, I really value Dr. Christine Courtois and Julian Ford write a lot about complex trauma, and that's really becoming better understood. They're trying to get a category for that in the DSM that hasn't yet happened. But what they're talking about with complex trauma is it doesn't have to be one acute experience. If something has happened over and over in ways that accumulate, then you may well be experiencing complex trauma without ever having had any one situation that was traumatic. So for example, chronic neglect and over time accumulate into, what does it mean? The person, it went beyond the person's ability to cope. So then they begin pulling and eating their hair as a way to cope. And then it's not like I'm going to find, oh, there was this one incident. No, but it was all of those days where your parents, who were also doing their best, were at work and you were left alone with your siblings and they picked on you, and, you know, whatever it may be, that there is a reluctance to sort of acknowledge that. Also, she defines looking at the experience of racism. And we really ignore that, number one, like racism in America has led to generational trauma, generational lack of housing opportunities and financial opportunities. And then there's the experience of discrimination and stereotyping and the way that that might affect your own relationship with your hair and your skin and lead to hair pulling. Well, that's a traumatic situation, but it's more in the air versus somebody actually, you know, calling you a name or, you know, beating you up on the playground, which may also be part of it. But
yeah,
that all those things we don't like to see, but there's a lot we have to cope with in this world. And and say that, that one person's experience, doesn't meet the level of trauma, if they're coping with it in a maladaptive way, then it went beyond their resources.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I really appreciated that definition, that like enriched sort of, just the language of whatever you're experiencing went beyond, you know, your kind of quote unquote regular coping mechanisms. I'm honestly thinking like social media by itself, that's just traumatic, right? That accumulated like every, you know, like one single Instagram post isn't going to give you trauma, but like the hours of scrolling, seeing these beautiful, perfect, curated lives that you do not have. Like, that's just trauma recipe 101. Wow,
that's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of it like that. And think how much everyone's scrolling, Jason.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. But I think, you know, like that's sort of speaking to your point. Like, well, you know, I think a part of my original question was like, you know, sometimes people are in like denial of trauma, right? Because I think trauma is too big of a word, right? Like, oh yeah, no, nobody like beat me up on the street because of the color of my skin. And that's sort of my experience as an Asian person in North America. So yeah, my experience isn't of maybe kind of like Black people, and yet I still experience racial trauma, but it's like, it's harder to like, there's not like one discrete story of, oh, here's the trauma event for me to explain my trauma to you. In order to like adequately explain my trauma, it's like you said, going to school every single day for 10 years and always feeling less. Like, that's the trauma. But people are like, I don't get it, you know?
Oh, Jason, thank you for sharing that. That makes it so clear. Yeah.
And I mean, I think the experience of like a woman, right? Like how much messaging every single day, like you said, like every day you wake up in the mirror and you're like, oh, not tall enough. My hair is not shiny enough.
Right. And then once you engage in your body focused behavior and it's like, then you're really obviously have a problem. And then the camouflage and then all of that winds into becoming its own problem. And totally. That's part of that circular nature. And then it's like that leads to more isolation, more frustration. You know, all of that. So,
Yeah.
A cycle.
So much, Stacey. We could probably weave in 18 more things. but yeah, thank you so much for joining me today and kind of.
Thank you, Jason. Yeah. Thanks for the questions.
I would love to hear, I don't know, is something next for you? Like, do you have another book in the works or like, do you have, something that you're working on?
That's a great question. Well, right now, so no more books ever.
ever.
Yes, I did complete a chapter for a book, a case study for a book that will be coming out through the APA called Clinical Psychodermatology, and I believe Dr. Jeff Rainey is the one who's editing that. So keep your eyes out for that. And then I'm doing a lot of training and presenting. I'll be at the American Group Psychotherapy Association Connect is what their conference is called. That's in March. And I'm doing a full day workshop with group portions most of the day. So that'll be exciting. And then I'm presenting right after that at the psychodermatology conference in New Orleans. And that one's funny because it's only these dermatologists, they have 15-minute presentations versus like an all day. So that one I'll be like cramming in a little bit of information. I've been doing a lot of training of like group practices, mostly here in Texas, but I really enjoy doing an online training for like a whole group practice. And then I can put them on my referral list. So if any of your listeners want to be part of that, I get referrals for all over the country, even in Canada, I do. and I look for additions to that referrals list. And then I offer training groups. So 10-week virtual training groups, that I'm thinking, this is my second one, but I'm thinking of holding another one in April and then again, maybe in October. So holding those regularly based around the book. Oh, I have my book here. So, I'm really just looking to spread and just train more therapists to work in a depth-oriented approach. I have someone in my current training group who came from the Combi CBT perspective and is really like sort of enjoying the deepening of, this relational part and some of these other pieces. And so, I would love for people to be exposed to, there's more than one approach. If you're interested in going to the roots, CBT, that's not where they suggest we go. So there's got to be another way.
Right. Okay. Yeah. In maybe to the listeners out there, if anything that they heard today sparked your interest, would they be able to reach out to you? Do you have a wait list? What's the best way if they're interested in working with this different approach?
My website is stacynakel.com, stacynakell.com. And on there, people can fill out. I have a very few openings that come up here and there. So you can feel free to fill out to get on my wait list or to, I do have a couple of group openings. One of the groups is virtual. So I am only licensed in Texas. And if you reach out to me from another state, I can try to connect you with someone else. But for anyone in Texas, and then as far as therapists, I can train any therapist from anywhere. And then you can go and be a resource there. So
yeah,
all of that people can reach out to me through my website.
Okay, amazing. Again, listeners, check out Stacy's book, Treatment for Body-Focused Repetitive Behaviors, An Integrative Psychodynamic Approach. Stacy, thank you so much for doing the work that you do. And you'll have to come on again next time.
That's great.
Okay, bye.
Bye.